From where we left yesterday, yesterday we ended up with verse 24, and then today we'll be starting with verse 25. And so.
Thank you, Chair. Verse 25 deals with the right of appearance. One of the insertions is that it relates to candidate legal practitioners also. The committee requested us to, let me start others. Initially the bill only provided that attorneys have the right to appear in any court, such as advocates. That was a new thing that change of the status quo that the bill provided for. At the request of the committee, this was limited again by inserting the provisions of the current Right of Appearance Act, where an attorney who wants to appear in a High Court, Supreme Court of Appeal or Constitutional Court must apply for this right at the registrar. And also a new thing that was inserted that isn't in the Right of Appearance Act is in clause 25(3) paragraph D, namely that such an attorney must have gained appropriate relevant experience prescribed by the minister. And at the last discussion of the committee on 15 August, it was decided that this function of the minister must be done in consultation with the council. And then also this bill, this insertion goes further by providing the right of appearance of candidate attorneys. This is the status quo as it is currently, and it's just inserted in the bill for purposes of candidate attorneys where they might appear and where.
Before comment, then I take the...
Sorry, Chair, just a bit more background to remind members. The right of appearance of candidate legal practitioners here is only limited to candidate attorneys. I just want to remind members of that. We couldn't deal with pupils because this is the current situation in terms of current legislative framework, and there's no legislative framework at this stage relating to pupils, so that's why it is only limited to candidate attorneys.
Okay. Chairperson, if I could just add one other aspect that the minister will be looking to, it's under 25(3A). You see that the last sentence reads, provided that this period may be reduced in accordance with the rules made by the council, if the attorney has undergone a trial advocacy training program. You'll remember that there was debate and deliberation as to whether attorneys that have gained sufficient experience by their prior exposure might be compromised if they have to go through the mandatory 3-year waiting period before they can appear. And after consideration, the committee asked for an alternative process to be put in and to be factored in. So that provision as well is a new provision to the existing provision, the Attorneys Act, that if an attorney has undergone that trial advocacy program, the period could be reduced.
Okay. Shall I not take any comments or questions, Honourable Mutsafa?
I wonder, is this not an attempt at gatekeeping? Because advocates do privilege, and I don't think they do privilege for 2 years. Attorneys serve articles for 2 years, and there are attorneys who may even be more qualified than some advocates. If an attorney has an LLB, he has a master's in law, and he has to be treated as if he still needs some advocacy training. I'm just wondering. I would understand if we say that person must apply to the registrar as a formality that the person must be registered as practicing in the Supreme Court. But again, if attorneys are admitted, they're admitted as attorneys of the High Court. So what additional thing do they have to do to be officers of the court? And also, if it is said that they must be the minister in consultation with the council must approve. When you have so many attorneys in the country, does really the minister have the time to be screening people for admission? It's another just bureaucracy which I think if any purpose this is going to serve, it's just gatekeeping.
Any further comments or questions before I give to the advocates to comment?
Yes, I think it's a decision that the committee must make. Ms. Lowe made the point that the bill has introduced did away with those distinctions that currently exist, and the committee requested an option to be drafted to bring back the current situation. So I think the committee needs to decide one way or the other whether what the situation would be. I think, if I remember correctly, and maybe Mr. Dyer can help me here, I think the attorney's profession, when this bill was still being negotiated and we were in consultation with the profession, I think they were very excited about doing away with distinction between advocates and attorneys as far as this is concerned. But I think it's something that the committee will have to decide itself at the end of that. I don't know whether Mr. Dyer wants to.
Yes, Honourable Swart.
So we had a discussion on concern that newly admitted attorneys appearing before the High Court, the experience of certain judges, that there was inexperience, and that was the concern, and that is why this suggestion was made. If one has a situation where you have a person with relevant experience with a master's degree or something, then that will fall under D, has gained appropriate relevant, that's the or. So there will be situations, or it can be, where a person doesn't have to wait 3-year period, and that will be under D, has gained appropriate relevant experience, such as an expert in competition law or something like that. Then that can be prescribed by the minister in consultation with the council. So that will cover the concerns about gatekeeping. But the general concern of the committee, if I remember correctly, was the fact of having inexperienced prodigal clerks or professional assistants that then appear in the High Court and are not sufficiently qualified from an experience perspective. And I think there were concerns expressed by that. In one of the submissions, the Deputy Judge Resident of Gauteng expressed a concern about inexperienced attorneys or inexperienced legal practitioners. And that is why and it also went to the independent advocates. Remember, there was a concern about that as well, appearing before the High Court and the judges having to assist them. And if I remember correctly, that was the argument around Mr. Dyer. If you help me with that, I think that was the motivation why the committee suggested this provision.
I have nothing to add. It says, you know, when it's Mochapello, it's Mochapello. Yeah. When he says something like that, I mean, that's enough for me. So there's lots of concern for that.
All right. So we stick to the position that the portfolio committee suggested on our previous occasion. Okay. That's a little possible.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause is 26. There were some amendments to the bill as introduced at the request of the Portfolio Committee. If you could please just indicate, shall I go through everything or only where there are difficulties or several things that must be decided? I'm not sure what you would prefer. Thank you, Chair. Just one aspect in Clause 26 that was flagged by the Portfolio Committee is Clause 26.1 the underlined part, paragraph C, that community service will form part of vocational training. And this was flagged that when clause 29 is finalized, I think this will, it relates to each other. This whole community service aspect has been flagged. And, yeah, further, that is the only aspect here that... Yes, there was a legal practice management course also inserted for Canada legal practitioners, but that is, currently there is such a course for admitted attorneys, so this was just extended to form part of vocational training. But I don't think there was difficulties with this aspect.
If there are any questions, then...
Thank you. Clause 27, sub-clause 2 was inserted to provide for some form of remuneration for all candidate legal practitioners, including pupils that at the moment don't get paid. Yes, that was inserted here.
In other words, that it should be the castle that ensure that also the pupils should get some form of remuneration. It should not be at the discretion of the master. Okay. You can proceed then.
I just want to clarify this aspect. It is not to say that the castle will pay. It is that the castle will recommend a stipend in that regard for pupils. And I think we can read it so far, Mr. Secretary of the Council will pay. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes, we agree that there are understanding that there should be provision. Okay, you can proceed there as well.
Clause 29 provides for community service. Several options was in were inserted in here. The whole clause is quite difficult at this stage to read. Several decisions have to be made here. Initially, it was a short clause that provided that the minister must prescribe requirements for community service. And then there was a list saying what it would entail community service. The first option was inserted that just change the position that the minister will make regulations. So a shorter clause that would simplify the matter and just lead to regulations. Then another option was inserted that either the minister or the council might make rules or regulations, that it would be a compulsory component of practical vocational training, and that it would be compulsory for legal practitioners upon which their continued enrollment is dependent. And then there was also a list of what would community service entail. And the Human Rights Commission made a presentation in this respect, and that is why we inserted in the alternative option in subclause 3H, we inserted the Human Rights Commission, chapter 9, sorry, not a human rights, but a chapter 9 institution. And then there was also in the alternative option subclause 5, at request of the committee, there was a possibility for an exemption.
Can I just ask for clarity, what is the difference between CB and UEH? So CB serves as a supporting contribution on democracy. Is that not the same as chapter 9?
Yes, actually my personal opinion is that it is the same. But Yes, but
but we really need them, yes.
The only things that are institutions supporting constitutional democracy are at hand.
And this, Chair, perhaps if we could retain the word in Chapter 9 to make it clear. While supporting constitutional democracy can be...
Yeah. No, or, you know, by all means, Chair, but I mean, if you read your constitution, the title of Chapter 9 is Institutions Supporting Democracy.
Insert
Chapter 9.
Prescribed by law for anyone to volunteer.
Chairman, please just remind me where we use pro bono work, because that's something we must make sure of.
There's no provision in the law on pro bono, dealing with pro bono specifically.
Currently, the law society does require practitioners to do some form of pro bono.
Also, the bar council is 8 hours per year. And I'm not sure that that is always observed. I mean, I think I'm scientific.
Let us talk about it. Why do we think it is this bit? Do we...
Do we actually legislate it? Huh?
No.
I think that... I don't think we can prescribe the pro bono work. Here we are looking at what candidate legal practitioners need to do as compulsory component. It is done in submissions from the GCB, from the law. They set out the minimum amounts that they do. And that is pro bono work. That's High Court in pharma pauperis work that is done. And they've added that there's thousands of hours that are done there. And I intend to agree with Dr. Otseha. First time this morning. That we shouldn't prescribe that. That is required, and I'm sure that it is being done, and it's for those bodies themselves to make sure that it is done. But I think that we remember that most of your attorneys are single practitioners, one man, and for them to be prescribed that they have to do so many hours at them in their businesses, if they've got a busy practitioner. So I think, Chair, let's look at the requirement for your legal practice, your candidate, and your, and again, the other element is in your LLB curriculum, where there will be vocational training and community service. I think that's where we need to place this. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
So, that's our decision.
Yes, actually. Chair, that's fine. So we will take up paragraph B, what it boils down to. That might, if I may just get clarity, are we looking at the last alternative option? Is that the one that we're working on, Chair? So it will come out of that, so that's the one that will form the basis of this provision. If that's the case, and if it's only going to be community service done by candidate legal practitioners, I think we would most probably have to have a look at subclause 3, because there's an attempt being made to say what community service is. And it says community service for the purpose of this section may include, so it's not a closed list, but may include, but is not limited to the following. Bearing in mind, if it's only going to be candidate legal practitioner, then maybe the committee needs to provide guidance on some of those places where community service can be done, because I would think that a candidate legal practitioner, the question arises whether a legal practitioner should be doing community service as a judicial officer. My feeling would be that might be inappropriate. So we need to go through that definition of community service. And that paragraph D must stick out.
Yes, because the attorney cannot be a commission member for the claims court, nor be a judicial officer. Okay, honorable Mutaf.
I'm not sure if we are not confusing this. You know, candidate attorneys have got to write an exam at the end of the field. And whatever work they do as part of their training should prepare them for those exams. Now, if you are going to take them, send them somewhere in the rural areas, they do the work, and when they write the board exams, they don't pass. I thought community services would be lost for law students, that when they go to do their candidates, they have already done that part of the work. So maybe I'm not clear, but I didn't expect that community service would apply to candidates and tenants. You know, they are given 2 years to do that. But correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Chief. Clause 26 deals with qualifications, and that is the student. And at the request of the committee, there was an insertion that candidate legal. Sorry, sir, Chair. Let me just get my dog in a row here. Yes, that is also so that is also the candidate legal attorneys, legal practitioners.
Come in. We did just to take members back. We discussed it, and I think it was in clause 6, dealing with the powers and functions of the council. And that is on page. That's on page.
Yeah.
14. Yes, it's clause 6.5b. Just to remind members, we discussed it yesterday. The council, with regard to education in law and legal practice generally, may advise the council on higher education established in terms of the Higher Education Act regarding matters relevant to education in law, including the desirability of including in the LLB curriculum a form of community service to be undertaken by law, by all law students. And I pointed out yesterday that this is a bit of an unusual provision because we're not dealing with law students, we're dealing with legal practitioners. But there was a feeling, and that came from that panel discussion that was attended by our Deputy Minister and Ms. Ruprom, where we requested to try and accommodate in this bill a provision that will urge or exhort universities to include in their curriculum a component of community service, because not many universities do include that. So that's why that is in clause 6.5. Here we're dealing with, it is easier to include community service for candidate legal practitioners because that is what this bill is about. And my understanding is that the community service should be done by all candidate legal practitioners for the benefit that it brings, because this bill cannot really prescribe what law students have to study. That's dealt with in other legislation.
Lengthy discussions on the issue, and we also expressed our concerns about the concept of community service both for legal practitioners and article clerks. And maybe is the solution not to resort it right at the LB curriculum? That is possibly where you've got your legal clinics, you've got your legal aid clinics, and maybe that might be a solution where we leave it under 6.5b. We said it, including the desirability of including in the LLB curriculum a form of community service. So it's in legislation there, and almost those two seem to, although it's not our jurisdiction, but it is something that we'll have to, and you remember the submissions from some universities that said it is already part of the LLB courses. So surely that is where it's the most desirable, considering that it, and that would be the concept of legal aid clinics at universities. That is what I think is intended. And I think it is, again, as we discussed, that it would be difficult where you've got an article clock under principal in the city or in, to then send that article clock out to a rural area to go and do legal work where the principal isn't watching the work that he's doing. You recall my concern about the level of legal aid that that article clock renders to clients where the principal, his principal, is not checking his work. So I think we need to
reconsider this whole issue, and we had a lot of debates and we expressed our concerns about this, and I think that it is something that it should maybe resort at the LLB level. That is where it is, to me, it is well suited there.
Then we require law schools to have legal aid in, and then law students do their provincial work through their peers. So I think it's cleaner than the way it is now.
I want to just reiterate the position that was articulated quite clearly by the previous committee member, the current deputy minister. And his views were that, and I think it was also then further expanded by Mr. Spasana, that in creating the legal practice role, what we're also doing is creating a South African attorney in the context of South Africa, and that whilst we have the differences of the past, it's not unforeseeable that people coming through the various universities and the systems they're exposed to are out of touch with the rest of the country. And that in creating at the level of the candidate attorney a need for at least 1 or 2 months of this exposure component of the term of the office of clerkship places this person in a holistic way of experiencing the rest of the country in the context of being a legal practitioner to serve not only commercial interests, but interests of South Africans generally. And in that context, there was sufficient debate gone into the whole issue of community service that we want to produce a South African lawyer, a South African advocate, given our past. And those discussions happened in this committee, and I had sensed that although there was concerns about the recurring community service aspect for legal practitioners, that the sense I had got was that at least at the level of candidate attorneys, that there would be consideration at that level as being a component to that for the reasons in which I'm submitting was considered by the committee. And that there is no guarantee if we remove that now, that submission and the considerations by the Council for Higher Education might necessarily take that in. And if that is the position, we then sit with the whole issue of community service totally slip into the net. And I would ask for the committee to seriously look at this in the context of the previous discussions that the committee had, and in context of what they're seeking to achieve in terms of the holistic legal practitioner that is able to serve South Africa in a holistic way.
There is value in what Mr. Baer is saying, because if we agree that at the LLP level, universities will establish legal aid clinics so that the LLP students do practical things, but now the candidate attends upon completion, not during their training, upon completion, you say, for 18 months before they set up their own practice, they go and do community work. But after complete, something like that, then that would accommodate that. But I think I'm persuaded by that argument that we can just find out where do we fit it.
We're talking about article talks, aren't we? In the six, we're talking about article talks. So really, it's the attorney's appeal, the absence of the article talks. No. I respect what Mr. Rajdhani is doing. I mean, it's faithfully reflecting what now a member of the executive thought. But we are the legislators. I don't care what the member of the executive thought. And I thought that we were making really very good progress on this. I mean, Dr. Moshiha is powerful. I'm sure he can ensure that the relevant higher education laws and organs require community service from the LLPC. I liked the way the conversation was going, which I guess is now, we no longer have that agreement. So it's really for whom the article clock works, who will really bear the absence of this young person who is then away working for the Public Protector or the Human Rights Commission or one of the other things under subsection 3.
I don't think anything has changed. And also, I don't think it's wrong to take advantage of the wisdom that came before, whether people are in the executive or not. I think the question is, if we need community service for unvisited tenants, at what stage should that happen? During their training, or before they set up, they are allowed to set up their own practice. And that is something that we can regard as food for thought for the officials. They can apply their mind to it. But I think we have agreed with regard to the LLB that will be done through legal aid. So we could leave it there and put this in the good hands of the officials. No, they are lawyers.
They have to do what we want.
No, they are lawyers. They are impartial.
Thanks, Chair. I think also what's important is to do the time frame. You talk about LLP students doing community service for how long? That's important, even when they do articles last year. And that would be probably in terms of the number of hours that they will spend on this. The rate, it will articulate to 6 months. That's one thing that needs to actually be clearly articulated for both. But I agree with the concept that we can actually bring it into LLB and then also at Article 6 level.
I have not taken this from. Maybe just to say, we should cut against taking the ground that we have covered previously, and we only concentrate on those issues that we must still look at. Them. I don't know, because I'm not encouraging any more thought that we take on this thing, because if Vinicius said that a clever man changes his mind, I think even women also changes his mind.
We have been agreeing with you, we still agree with you, but I think this matter was concluded yesterday, but it arises now because we are dealing with the community service again, but in another context. So we have found a way of linking the two. But now I think we agree that we leave the matter in the hands of the officials to see how they can put that in better language and to context.
Mr. Fern, you wanted to come in?
As Ms. Kalani Jarki said, it's going to be important as to the time frames and when. But if we went for an option like they have in the medical profession, where they have the community service after they have qualified, or part of their qualification, I think the state actually pays them to do that. And then also the other question is, if it's done afterwards and it's in a big bump, then who's actually going to be accountable for their work? So, I mean, those are just sort of two practical questions in my mind.
I think that these are two good questions, but they would require research and not something that we should do. We can just get the officers to know it and to look into that when they find out.
Just to assist, the draft is then we are in agreement that 6-5 is where it's seated. Now, are we then going to have on page 32 that clause 391A, all legal practitioners, and that will then, maybe we should just agree to leave that clause in 391A, so that the council and or the minister will then at a later stage pass the rules that will determine what that will be together with DME, just to assist our thinking. So that our sentiment is that it should be resorted and with the LRB, but we're not excluding the possibility that the council and or the minister can make rules to also require candidate legal practitioners to do community service, and that will then be investigated. Otherwise we will delay this process if we have to come up with the finality. Are we on, is that what you think?
Bravo, Chair. I think that is brilliant. And so that clause 29 stops after clause 1. You don't even go to A and B, and we just delete the rest of the clause. I mean, really, we've had many discussions on this matter, and we're now starting all over again. Just leave it. Just leave it for 29.1. We're saying the council will make rules, and the minister must, you know, after consultation with council, make regulations regulating community service. And just leave the rest.
Okay. That sounds fair. Shall we then proceed there?
Thank you, Chair. This clause is clause 30. It relates to enrollment with the council. I don't think there was anything that was specifically flagged by the committee. It's more a technical clause. And same as clause 31, it relates to cancellation and suspension of enrollment. Nothing flagged there. Similarly, clause 32, when a petitioner wants to convert from one to the other. Clause 33 is authority to render legal services. There wasn't any changes recently on that. Clause 34 relates to forms of legal practice. At the last meeting of the committee on 13 August, some changes were made here. 34.1 provides an attorney may render legal services in expectation of a fee on request directly from the public, and then 2 A and B was changed after discussion at the last meeting. 2B, the committee requested that we delete paragraph 2B2 and an alternative, an addition was done to say that an attorney, an advocate may render legal services in criminal or civil matters in expectation of a fee, etc., or at request of a Justice Center, which is LASA, and then B won't apply. In other words, it doesn't have to have a Fidelity Fund certificate. The or civil was included after a request by Honourable Member Schaefer. LASA first indicated that they only want to give direct briefs to in criminal matters, but they say usually they act as attorney in civil matters, but it won't do any harm to insert it here. So we inserted it there after the last discussion. And then in subclause 3, there were also changes made to delete paragraphs C and D and to insert new 4, that the council must make rules relating to the instruction of attorneys. That was more a drafting changes, not really the essence. And then in the new subclause 5 is where the Human Rights Commission comes in. They also want their employees who are attorneys to be able to practice that attorney's work at the Human Rights Commission be considered to be a form of legal practice, similarly the advocates in the new clause 6D. It transpired that it is only the Human Rights Commission of the Chapter 9 institutions whose practitioners do words such as we would consider practicing attorneys and advocates, but they do not need Fidelity Fund certificates because they don't receive any funds. So the department, at the request of the committee, inserted their my provision for them there. Justice Singer is defined in clause 1. An office of legal aid South Africa and includes a satellite office.
When members of society were able to establish advisors, they were everywhere, they were effective, but they were receiving donor funding. This justice center, you will hear that the minister is establishing something there and something there. And it would seem we have taken the initiative out of the hands of the committee and wants to do it as government. And whether we are doing enough, that's the question. But with regard to other NGOs, they establish themselves, they register with social development and are funded. Whether maybe at some point we shouldn't look at that kind of model and leave it to communities to take initiatives and find a way in which government can support communities' initiatives, other than having a government that says, I will do everything for you and make people dependent on government.
Because my experience is that you find that this center having established an office, and then at the same time you have satellites. Their employees are placed in some areas far from the center itself. And then in addition to that, where they don't have a satellite, they visit magistrates' courts, but it is not every day, on certain days, periodically, they visit magistrates' court periodically. Now, to have a question as to how many are they? I'm a proper justice center.
You are happy to have this. If you are happy, I'm happy
to know. No, I'm not saying here, I'm just explaining their presence. It is there. Whether or not it is sufficient, I can't vouch on that.
I'm just thinking that on page 10,
page 7, number 4, that was actually on chapter 9 institution that makes reference to the Human Rights Commission. I think it's just best to just read the chapter 9 institution. The Human Rights Commission might have made their submission, but to actually then exclude others might constitute a problem. Limit the chapter 9 institution.
No, hang on. I mean, we're talking about two different things. The one is where your candidate attorney can go and do service. Now we're in the other clause. We're talking about forms of legal practice. And, I mean, Wilma has just said that it is only the Human Rights Commission of all the chapter 9s that requires this recognition in this clause, because they have advocates and they have attorneys and they don't need Fidelity Fund certificate. Right?
The CG, Commission on Gender Equality, also has got attorneys in the but leave it as chapter 9, whether they qualify or not, you don't create a situation where you find that there will be legislative framework that excludes others. If they don't qualify, well and good, but the legislation would decide that it does not actually outright exclude them.
I would support the position.
Mr. Bertrand, and then I think
Thank you. And I think we mentioned it previously, in terms of the legislation, the Human Rights Commission is the only one that's given the specific power to litigate of the Chapter 9 institutions. So they can appear in court on behalf of the people they are supporting or assisting. And that's why, and I think that's what the committee accepted on a previous occasion, the reason why the Human Rights Commission has been set apart, as it were, is because of their litigation role that they have in terms of their founding legislation.
And I think that that approach is a bit narrow, because legal practice would also include, if a commission is investigating a matter, it produces documents, briefs, and that is part of training. And therefore, I would say, let's open it a bit. There may be legal work that may be done in other commissions, which is not necessarily appearance in court. So I would still support the idea that let's just say Chapter 9 institutions, and where applicable, people can.
Mr. Gaya?
My recollection of the previous discussions at the committee level related to the need to manage this process responsibly in terms of accountability, because the duty to accept public funds as a concomitant right to hold a Fidelity Fund certificate is that what the section seeks to do is to look at all of those various ways in which an attorney or advocate may practice, and in which way he or she may practice. Legal Aid South Africa made extensive submissions and even brought about amendments to the Attorneys Act for them to be excluded because of their peculiar way in which they render legal services in the way they do. And I don't think the committee had any difficulty with regard to understanding the way in which Legal Aid South Africa operated. In fact, it went further and included the issue of civil work. Then, in the previous draft, just the Human Rights Commission was flagged because of the nature of the work it did. However, when the commission appeared, it did also say that it falls under the Legal Aid Clinic because it's linked to a Legal Aid Clinic and is approved by the Law Society rules. When one opens up blanketly that if you are part of a Chapter 9 institution, it's very wide, and what it does is it creates an opportunity for any Chapter 9 institution to be able to bypass this process in a way in which it could compromise the public institution. So if we flag these two institutions as being peculiar and they are noted in bold, that is a safety insofar as protection of the public is concerned. We spoke about Legal Aid South Africa, and again, insofar as the Human Rights Commission is concerned, it's linked to a law clinic. And the fact that as part of its work, it does receive monies that might relate to tribute damages, and it has a way of managing a process with an annual audit. The concern must be that if you open it blanketly, it casts a wide net without sufficient protection afforded to any possible malpractice that might ensue in the way in which you approach it. So I would suggest that the committee reflects this. Maybe it needs to be flagged, that perhaps maybe we need to do that. But for those reasons, I share those comments.
Honourable, sir?
Ask Advocate Modern Zeller, the public protector. She's an advocate. Where would she fall under? She's not. Attorney is my only practice, but she's not practicing then. Mm. Although she's an advocate in a role as head of the public protector, she would not be practicing as an advocate. Therefore, there's no need for a reference to that to the public protector here. Although she's got, she's probably got advocates. But she's got legal people that could be advocates that are investigators, but they're not practicing as advocates appearing in court. I mean, that's the distinction. Yeah. No, I'm not. That you said it's actually not even necessary to mention the Human Rights Commission, that it's actually a misreading that they are sufficiently covered, if I remember correctly.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, in a certain sense that if you look objectively to the provisions of this bill, which would regulate practitioners, say an attorney, an admitted attorney, gets appointed to the Human Rights Commission, he could go on the non-practicing role in terms of this role. But then you have to look objectively. That person work that he does he need a fidelity fund certificate? Does he fall within the ambit of a practitioner? So if you look objectively, I spoke to a person, Ms. Cohen, of the Human Rights Commission, the work that they do is very similar to that of a practitioner. So currently they are exempt at the law society, some of the law societies, from getting a fidelity fund certificate, etc. So they would prefer to be specifically recognized here because the work I do is actually the same as practitioners. But they still have to go through all the processes, other prescriptions of this Act, namely qualifications, vocational training, examination, etc. But if after that whole process they don't practice privately but they go to the Human Rights Commission, they would like to still be considered a form of legal practice for these purposes, but be exempt from the fidelity fund certificate requirement.
They would then not be on the non-practicing role, they'd be on the practicing role.
Yes. But currently their position is a bit vague. And that is why they require, they request a specific mention here to clarify their position. But it seems at the moment they are, they do actually practice.
Okay. Why do I deliberating about this? I don't know whether should I say, consider situation of the legal aid clinics at universities and the advice centers. They employ sometimes attorneys or advocates, but that legal aid clinic or that advice center then applies to the Law Society for accreditation, so that those people who are employed there were attorneys or advocates, they then can do what they normally the practitioner will do, but in the name of either the clinic or in the name of the advice center. So the liability or responsibility is borne by that center that applies it, not that person, the individual. Honorable Musa.
I think what you said now throws more light.
What it said throws more light on the justification for putting the law commission there. But it raises another question. But if I'm an attorney, I'm employed by the gender commission, wouldn't I add value if I'm also exempted from a fidelity fund so that I can practice there? Now, I think that can apply across the board. But I don't want to belabor that, but I think that for the reason that I stated, one could live with that inclusion, but just request that you look at that further, whether the same situation would not apply in other commissions, in case they apply, they employ lawyers, like Legal Aid Clinic and Jefferson, that employ lawyers, so that we open the space.
Right,
Chair, would the committee consider, in light of the submissions that have been made, would an amendment to be considered to effect that exemption to be applied for to council in whatever Chapter 9 institution believes they fall into this category or want to be exempted, that we create a paragraph that reads that application may be made to the council approved by the minister in consultation to deal with any and other Chapter 9 institutions that might exist out in Britain.
We would support that.
Thank you very much. Then you can proceed, Honourable Amina and Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Chair. Then still in clause 34 on page 39, there were some amendments. It relates to a law clinic's position, but I don't think there was specifically anything flagged. It was just amended at the request of the committee. And perhaps also regarding the other Chapter 9 institutions, this could also form part of this other forms of legal practice that the council must investigate, because the Gender Commission, etc., legal advisors might be similar to in-house counsel of big businesses. So, that could also fall under their perhaps, but I don't think anything serious was said here.
Okay, in absence of any comment or question, we can proceed then.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause is clause 35, relating to fees. Several changes were made here, also at the last meeting of the committee on 15 August. When the bill was introduced, clause 35 only provided, in short, that a petitioner, juristic entity or law firm may only charge fees in respect of fees in accordance with of structure as determined. This was changed to maybe described by regulation and what must be taken into account. Then there was an alternative option on page 40 at the top. There was an insertion at the last meeting referring to an investigation that must be completed. The investigation referred to is in subclause 4 on the next page. It is similar to that, the clauses named further option that was deleted now. It is just changed to make it easier to understand. I don't know, should I go through it, Chair? Okay, let me read. Perhaps I shall read the whole alternative option from the top of page 40. 35.1, until the investigation contemplated in subsection 4 has been completed and the recommendations contained therein have been implemented, fees in respect of legal services, etc., must be in accordance with the terms made by the Rules Board for courts of law. And then a specific Rules Board must take into account. Then, subclause 3, despite any other law to the contrary, nothing in this section precludes any user of knowledge and services on his or her own initiative or at his instigation, the wording must be decided on, from agreeing with the legal practitioner in writing to pay fees for the services in question in excess of and the new insertion or below any tariffs or determined. So the Rules Board, in terms of this option, the Rules Board would prescribe fees that the client and the practitioner can contract on lower or higher fees. Then on the next page, the new subclause 4, the Council must, within 2 years after the commencement of Chapter 2 of this Act, which relates to the Council, investigate and report that there should be transitional council, I think, or the council, I'm not sure, and report back to the parliament or the minister, the decision is needed, with recommendations of the following: ways in which to address the reasons why legal fees are too high and unattainable, legislative and other interventions in order to improve access to justice by the public, the establishment of a mechanism which will be responsible for determining fees and tariffs payable to legal practitioners, the composition of the mechanism contemplated in paragraph B, and the processes it should follow in determining fees or tariffs, the affording of users of to users of legal services the option of voluntarily agreeing to pay fees for legal services less or in excess of any amount that may be set by the mechanism contemplated in paragraph B, the obligation by a legal practitioner to conclude a mandatory fee arrangement with the client when that client secures that legal practitioner's services. In conducting the investigation, the first in subclause 4, the council must take into consideration the following: best international practices, the public interest, the interest of the legal profession, and the use of the contingency fee agreements. Then there's also a possible further insertion that the Minister Baba noted in the Gazette prescribed maximum tariffs payable where the state or a provincial or local government is the client, or that the Minister may, by notice, prescribe maximum tariffs payable to all legal practitioners.
Chairperson, I'm so sorry. For purposes of clarity, it will be the council and not the TC, because this will kick in once Chapter 2 comes into operation, which is your permanent council. That is the council, just to clarify that.
Question, Honourable Smith.
I want to offer you a further option, which draws to an extent on the further option. It would read as follows: the council must conduct an inquiry into legal fees and report its findings and recommendations to the minister for tabling in the National Assembly on the following: A, whether legal fees are placing legal services beyond the reach of most consumers. If so, what are the effects on legal practitioners and consumers respectively? B, that doesn't assume that legal fees are too high. It doesn't make any economic assumptions. It asks for an inquiry. B, what factors other than fees are impeding the efficient operation of legal services within the potential legal services market? C, whether the creation of a mandatory fee structure would be advisable. You know, I'm not at all convinced that it would be advisable. If so, who should determine it and set fees and tariffs? It's your mechanism idea. D, whether such a scheme should allow for exemptions where a legal practitioner is willing to work for a lower fee than that which is set, or a client is willing to pay more. And then 5 should be as is, best international practice, the public interest, etc. And of your subsections 6, the last one I don't find acceptable. I mean, the minister can't go around gazetting maximum tariffs payable to legal practitioners. We have to try to get the free market operating. We have to try to get the legal services and the legal services markets to find each other. And the way to do that is to encourage innovation, creativity. It's not to lay down the law, as it were. You just stultify the whole thing. So the way I phrased my proposal, which, Chair, with your permission, I will give to the law advisors, is to frame it more as a really an inquiry. It sets the questions. In fact, one could leave it open-ended. One could add something. You know, this is not just a first stab at the subject, but one could leave it even more open. They must go and look for all the factors. What is it?
I'd like to look at what Ms. Nuts suggests, and maybe we could put that in as an option, because it seemed very much similar to what we got under 4, but just under 35.3, I like insertion of or below for non-litigious matters. the point that I made was your multinational commercial, your competition matters and your patent. I think Adams said their clients are prepared to pay up more than the tariffs because of the nature of the work and the billions of rands that are implicated with patent law. So excess or below, that's for non-litigious matters, would you commercial mergers and acquisitions. And then there we can look at SAFOR and we can consider what Ms. Smuster said, but under the two alternate sixes, I'm not in favor of either of those sixes. And you'll remember my arguments, firstly about state departments. Firstly, they should be using the state attorney. Now, the problem comes in when they are not using the state attorney to brief advocates, and they are using private attorneys which use their costs, and we should maybe put something in our resolution at the end of this that we recommend that all state departments should make use of the state attorney. It's when they use private attorneys to brief advocates that the costs escalate. But the second point that I made is where you've got the state involved in multi, the state is the biggest litigant in the country. Our Minister of Justice has complained about the numbers of cases that he is losing. So we can't cap amounts because you will not be able to attract the senior counsels if you cap fees that they can pay. Take, for example, the e-tolling case. Billions of rand, there's 20 billion rand at stake there. You've got to have the top lawyers, the top senior counsel. Why should the opponents against the state have the top lawyers? If you cap your fees, you're not going to get the top lawyers arguing for you. So that is a consideration. I appreciate the counter side of that is that advocates are milking the state. But you strike that balance so that the state does not lose cases because of counsel, the top counsel not being available, I think is a very difficult balance to strike. I'm not in favor of a second six, definitely not, because that presupposes that let us do the inquiry, let us look also, and bear in mind what Mr. Scassano also said about the whole inquiry into litigation by the state. That is ongoing by the department. The state litigation is a separate inquiry that the department is undergoing. State litigation in itself, the role of the state attorney, and that. So I think we need to be very careful for those insertions. I'm not in favor of the two sixes. So subject to that here, and looking at what Ms. Smuster says, I think we are almost there with 35, 1 up to 5. That will be my submission. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. No,
I want to agree with the Honourable Dean, but after the inquiry, the Minister must table that in Parliament. But you see, I am having a problem with this kind of fear of government on the part of the TA. You see, you are able to agree that in B, that the establishment of a mechanism which will be responsible for determining fees and tariffs payable to the practitioners. If it's done by a mechanism, you are ahead with it. May I finish? Then when it comes to the minister gazetting the maximum tariffs, you have a problem. And I will tell you why I have a problem with you then. Because legal practitioners may charge fees that are unreasonably high. And now you need a referee who can stop that. And I can't find any person better place to do that than the minister. Because, you see, if we say we want top advocates, the top advocates charge high fees, and who must pay? It is the government using the public funds. And of course, if advocates charge more, it means also that the attorneys must charge more. And then the fees escalate, and then the whole fiscus is there just to for litigation. So I think we must then, with regard to Section 6, apply the standard of reasonableness, that the minister must determine whether the fees charged are reasonable in the circumstances, and therefore we make the minister a referee.
Thanks, Chair. I think before we can actually think of how the state is actually milled by the legal practitioners and things, what we need to do to go back to the purpose of the bill to have affordable legal services. Because why that happens is because of this runaway train of legal fees. That affects not only the state, but it affects even ordinary people of South Africa. So basically, I think what's just important is to always come back to the fact that we want to actually, at the end of the day, come up with a system in South Africa that manages to create affordable legal services for access to justice to really become real. I do actually think that in a manner in which this section has actually been articulated, how we have discussed it previously. And I understand what Honorable Smart is trying to bring in, and of course it has been articulated by Honorable Musaka maybe out of years. But what has been laid here is what we actually really engaged on and came to the agreement on. And I don't understand why now, as if we want to move away from it.
With respect, this bill as tabled included for the first time any reference whatsoever to fees. That reference was that a fee structure should be created. That doesn't mean setting fees, it means a fee structure. That in fact, the French plan. We have been discussing and evolving our ideas. This is not a final proposal. Anyway, somebody's drafting. So if somebody's drafting, is somebody drafting? And that's, you know, please, it's not the case that we have agreed on something. This is the first time we've seen it. Doctor, I did not say that I agree to the establishment of a mechanism. On the contrary, in my draft I say whether the creation of a mandatory fee structure would be advisable. If so, who should determine it and set fees and tariffs? Because what you've got to get to is the other thing I said. What are the factors, fees, but what other factors are impeding the efficient operation of legal services within the potential legal services market? There's something wrong. There are too many legal practitioners sitting without work and worrying about the income, whilst at the same time most South Africans feel they can't afford to work. There's something wrong. The services and the market must meet each other. All it takes is somebody has to think more innovatively, more creatively. And somebody must, someone must do an inquiry to figure out what are the factors. I think maybe some of the practice rules are part of those factors, but somebody must go and find out, do some real thinking, some real inquiry. We can't sit here and say, okay, that's the problem, therefore we allow now the minister to write mandatory fees. It's no wonder you can't achieve economic growth in the country, Dr. Marcel. I mean, you can't do it like that. So somebody must do an inquiry, and I'm going to give my proposal to the advisor. Chair, may I just refer to something I referred to yesterday? The doctor and I both want to do something now for consumers, for South Africans. I don't know whether our committee clerk has yet had the chance to send to everybody, all the members, but also the law advisors, the Australian example. Have you done anything about that? Because, Chair, this is something that could mean something concrete. It's very long, I don't want to read it to you. But there, in the Australian National Legal Reform Legislation, they provide that legal costs charged must be fair and reasonable in all the circumstances, proportionately reasonably incurred, etc., etc. Then they have specific requirements for costs disclosure. A law practice must, when taking instructions, provide the client with information disclosing the basis on which the legal costs will be calculated in the matter, and an estimate of the total legal costs, and the client must be informed if there's a significant change to anything previously disclosed, and non-compliance with disclosure obligations has consequences. For example, costs agreements become void. There's a lot of stuff which I think that we could incorporate, but
That means members must kindly go and read this, if you like, the sound of it. Apart from disclosure, forgive me, there was something else I thought we could incorporate. But disclosure is a kind of a minimum. It's such an obvious thing in a way. Instead of holding clients hostage. For the billing, we could look at. They also have a system of cost assessment, which is something different from the inquiry we are asking for. Christine, what's the other excellent thing? It's the cost disclosure. What? Progress report on your cost so that you aren't suddenly confronted with a bill you can't afford.
And also overcharging disciplinary
action. Yes, disciplinary action follows if you don't conduct yourself properly as a practitioner. Won't you, Chairman, won't you please have a look at this? Because I think it's something we could legislate. We do it now. We do not therefore have to wait for an inquiry, which will only happen once Chapter 2 comes into force, which will be 3-4 years hence. And it's such an obvious thing to ask in a way. Disclosure of your costs. You make a deal with your client up front. If stuff changes, you have to consult your client.
Can I just clarify something? That we have actually discussed this, and I'm saying so because I do know that Honorable Swart actually kept on emphasizing non-litigious matters, and that at a time a suggestion was made about a contingency fee legislative framework, which we said you need to go and investigate on it because we didn't have information on it. But I can see that even if you don't actually make reference to it, this is quite in line with what we have actually discussed before. Just to clarify that.
You know, if we want to give people access to justice, we must not complicate things and try to go to Australia. You see, legal practice has existed in this country a long time ago. And if there is a bill in the Supreme Court, you'll correct me, the bill can be taxed. To check whether the fees are not unreasonably high. So there's already a practice that exists. Now, to go and complicate this legislation with that is not advisable because we're also dealing with a society that is really illiterate, rural areas. And you see, our people, when they have to go to court, they go like victims. They don't even accept their right. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, day before yesterday, someone phones me and said, I went to a lawyer, and then the lawyer says I must pay a deposit of 15,000. I paid. Now we are going back to court, but the blood sample is not yet available. And the lawyer says that before he goes to court, I must pay another 15,000. And the client says it means the matter will be postponed again. And when we go back to court, this man wants another 15,000. So at the end, the client says, no, but I can no longer afford even this 15,000. What do I do? So I'm saying that appearing once in court to postpone a case cannot cost 15,000. And this is what people are subjected to. Now, that's why one feels that there must be a mechanism that determines the fees and the terms. And there must be a referee in the form of the minister who is able to say, no, you have gone too far. And this is something simple that can be couched in this legislation without introducing this complicated Australian provision.
That's not what the minister wants, by the way.
Can I say, you said correctly that we are the legislature. We are not being dictated from outside. No, we have to apply our minds.
Yeah. Okay. Can I say, I think the House must agree that the question of cost is biting to the public. Because as late as this weekend, one practitioner from Pretoria was saying to me, they are concerned because the judges are even starting now to challenge the contingency agreement that they agree with them with a client. And then I said to that person, no, I think there is no smoke without fire. And then I even encouraged that person to say, maybe write to the committee clerk, and then if it reaches us before we finalize this bill, we have an opportunity to look at it. The courts, the judiciary are even taking it upon themselves to be concerned about the fees that are being charged. So let us have some avenues. Say, I'm not saying capping, but to come at the rescue of the people who are there, who cannot do it all for themselves.
I also don't agree, understand why Dean and myself agree. Because she agreed that fees must be fair. And if we accept that standard, we have to say what mechanism we put in place to ensure fairness in this movement, and who is the referee to ensure fairness in this movement. So I think we agree, just as she goes to Australia before.
Honorable
Chair, I think you must understand what Ms. Dean Smash is saying. And she's saying that it would be helpful to the consumer. And Dr. Mateka's point about the criminal case, if that client comes to his attorney for that criminal case, and there's an obligation in terms of the Act that the attorney must tell him what it's going to cost. That's the disclosure. Because you enter, what happens at the moment, you go and see the attorney, but there's no indication that it's going to cost $15,000 each time. So up front, when you go and brief a criminal lawyer to represent you, he must tell you what is it going to cost so that you are aware. You can't write $15,000 just for a nip bonus. That's overreaching. That's totally unacceptable. But the benefit, one can look at something that maybe a way of this that obliges the legal practitioner to advise his client as to what is it going to cost. That's the one issue. The next issue, of course, relates to the reasonableness of fees that are charged. Now, we know we've got the rules board is a mechanism at the moment that determines the tariffs for bills of costs on a party-on-party basis. That is, if you win your case. If you lose your case, you've still got to pay attorney and client costs to your own attorney. That can also be taxed. So there is already a regulatory framework for litigious costs. Advocates can charge you as a client anything. If you win the case, what you can recover is subject to the taxing master and the reasonableness, and that's where the courts have come in now. And the Constitutional Court judgment that said that appeal costs was far too high and halved the advocate's fees. So there is already, the courts are looking at the extent of costing and what advocates are charging. That is why my suggestion is let this inquiry proceed. Let it finish its work. Then it can come back and propose the minister in consultation with the council can then, if it is necessary at that stage, at the point of after the inquiry, to then come out and look at. Because the mechanism there, as I understand it, is the rules book, surely. That is being re-looked at to look at the whole issue of tariffs and that. Now that's your litigious work, your court cases. The non-litigious side is covered with three, largely covered. Because they're non-litigious, you can ask an attorney to draft a contract for you. You can then negotiate below, or if it's a very complex international acquisition and merger, you can agree to pay more. So I'm still saying that we need to have that inquiry first about it.
We have nothing to fight over because the inquiry must continue and the rest will follow from that inquiry. So why don't we accept these provisions as they stand to allow the inquiry to proceed?
Because I don't like the provision the way it's written and it can be better written. How you frame an inquiry is very important, isn't it? You must make assumptions in your terms of reference. And Dr. You and I yesterday both agreed this bill should be about the people. In the words you didn't say, but I said, this bill for 12 years has been about the government versus the professions. It should be about the people. Consumers. Now, I offer you the Australian examples because then we can legislate immediately in favor of our people who are the clients, who are consumers of legal services, and who are held hostage by not knowing what the costs are going to be, and this helps them. Why are you allergic to something because it's from Australia? We read right around the world.
We still agree, you and I, that it's about the people, but
yes.
The people want fairness and reasonableness.
But what's your problem with reading something about Australia?
It's too complicated.
It's not. It's just simple.
I think if I can try to mediate the difference.
Can we just say that I think we agree, all three of us here, all four of us. The only thing is that the wedding. But I think the wedding is something that we should leave to the drafters because they have the expertise, not ourselves.
You decide the concept.
Let's look at the wording. Let's look at the wording. But I think the inquiry, but for those two sub-sixes, we need to have further debate as to when and how that will kick in. I would like to see that inquiry. I don't want suddenly next week when we pass the bill, the minister suddenly passes and he caps all the fees. You see that?
Absolutely not.
That, as it is presently worded, that can happen. So we need to, that's why we would need to relook at those words. Those two sub-sixes, we did discuss it, but it's a tentative insertion. There was no agreement on that. Definitely we discussed the possibility and the need, but there was no agreement on that. So let's look at the different formulations. I don't think we're too far apart.
Yeah. Why don't you agree that we ask the drafters to take those concerns into account and finalize the matter?
By the way, Chairman, may I just advise Dr. Moseka? The BLA is in favour of a free market. Did you know that? That's got to be your point of departure. You don't start writing...
The BLA, with respect, is an organisation of lawyers who are working for profit. We are saying we must balance the interests of the lawyers and the people. Their colour doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what colour you are. The important thing is that what you do must not exploit the people. It must be fair.
And this would be the only profession that is then regulated as far as its fees is concerned. Mm-hmm. And you remember the deliberations I had about the doctors, mm-hmm. the charge, whatever. They are not regulated. Surely it is more necessary that your health services, when you go see a doctor, that's life-changing. That's life in this situation. They're not regulated at all. You've got your medical aid tariffs here. Mm-hmm. So just to put it into a context of regulating a service that is being rendered. But let's move on. Let's look at it when we get the suggestions back again. Thank you, Chair.
I appreciate with an open mind. Chairperson, would there be any objection to the aspect of capping of fees to be a point added into the investigation? Would that be a good compromise to consider?
Because then it would be part of the investigation even to determine if the power is given, what would be the limitations. I don't think it's unreasonable to make that part of the package, because even that provision of capping would have to be factored in, or it will have to kick in at some stage, not immediately. So I think let's have that compromise.
Prepared to engage further. Okay. Sarita, sit. Oh, okay. I'm worried that. Can we take a how many minutes tea break?
Ten.
Not 10, too much. 10. Let's say 10. 10 minutes. Or 15. Okay, 15 minutes tea break.
My friend Dean's words.
Oh, you're going to drive me crazy.
So do you ask now? Do you ask?
Pardon? Oh, I think a little bit later, because it's still quite early.
Oh, okay. It's so worried of me now. What do I do?
What do you mean?
If I don't have to be here the whole time.
No, you don't have to be here the whole time. You can leave.
So the people that spoke today, so Lauren, that's white guy, I was saying. He's abnormal, but he was the one, you know, the three people that
spoke
today? Yes, the main guy. And then the other guy was
a cop called Rush.
His name is awesome before, and what's going on with the name Simba.
The other was the other.
This one?
Yes. Yeah.
So those are the only
ones that actually spoke.
Yeah, the ones that actually spoke. This one didn't speak.
She didn't speak. She don't. No, she didn't speak. So what did you mention that she played in?
No. And everybody else is absent.
And absentee is
like that. He just wanted here. He just wanted here. Yeah. Yeah.
Pardon? You coming in?
every day.
No, on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Nice.
Oh, you mean at work?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm at work every day.
So what do you mean?
The meetings are only Tuesdays and Thursdays. Sorry, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So that's when I come to Friday. About every other day I'm at work. That's
Pinky. Oh, okay. So the thing is that as well, it was the thing as well.
No, no, it's volunteer. It's not. I'm not going to escape by PNG at all. It's an agency, so the government of Canada is the one that sent me. So they have to give me my living cost.
Yeah.
So they're the ones that are supplying my living, I guess. Yeah.
So if you don't speak, you don't necessarily need to be
no.
Okay. And they're all from the Department of Justice, eh?
So I bring up just a constitutional development.
Wow, you're really on the ball of the day, like, I'm like...
No, you'll get into it, I guarantee.
Wow.
Like, in the beginning? Let me see.
I'm like, my mind.
I like, I'm
okay, I'm still by the first. It's like, I get it, but it's just like...
Honestly, this whole thing that they're talking about, I have no idea. So I have to go back and do a reading on it,
mm-hmm.
and then write my report, and I don't know anything that they're saying.
Oh, but then you have that. Luckily.
I don't, but I hate that.
You can imagine, because it's just like goes on for hours. But now, you see it like your session is normally 2 hours.
So, around 12:30.
Before, like, it comes
oh, usually the longest meeting that I have been to is three and a half hours.
Okay.
So that was the longest.
So 9 to like, so it was like 10,
36.
Yeah,
it was from like 9 to 12:30-ish.
Yeah. So that's the normal session, basically. Mm-hmm.
Some people are really lucky and they have
ideas. But then they like say, like they were able to train.
Yeah. Usually, depending, they'll have like 9 to 11, 9 to 2 hours, which is one. That's enough. By that second hour, you're like,
yeah, you want something? Can I?
Do you want me to give you the note? Or do you want
What do you mean now?
What, do you want my report? Is that what you want?
No, I just want to see like the, what you so far that I can pay.
Oh, these notes are so bad.
No.
But anyways, I'll do it.
Fine. Because I mean, I just want to like, take some simple ones in certain things. Because, I should say I'm just like you, 2 pages. I can't really like also go in deep.
That's true. Okay.
Well, I like this card.
Oops.
Mind that. It's a very professional.
No, I love that mixing. I'm always like bumping in. Like okay, no. No.
I don't see the point in this also, honestly, the whole community thing is not going to work. It's not going to work. There's no way that people is like actually going to be able to... There's no supervision and there's no
I don't know much about like the I don't know much about this community to be quite honest. It's my first meeting to this committee, but
what I'm noticing the most about the community is that they go through their building the whole day. And it's like a year down the line, they're still talking about the same thing.
They refer back to it.
They refer back to it all the time. I'm like, so when?
So what's the point?
What are you doing? So, what were you guys doing last year? Talking about the bill? I think it's strange on my system. Wow. That's like, I need to watch
this. Hey, this is my one. Clearly you.
Okay, so it's right here. It's titled Justice and Constitutional Reformer.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
I'll check the code for it.
I'm sorry, I stole your stuff.
She just estimates almost the what it was.
Oh yeah, there are. Since my phone decided to die on me, once it's done, I just hop it onto my computer,
mm-hmm.
and then once I have it out of my computer, I just get back to it.
Repeat.
N.
Double E.
Double E.
E.
Okay.
N. N.
First name basis.
What is your last name?
Sadi.
Sadi?
Sadi. S-A-L-I-E.
S-A-L-I-E. Are you Muslim?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Me too. I know, every time I talk to people, I'm like, oh, yeah, I was like, yeah.
That's what you know, the fans.
Mm-hmm.
Well done.
My parents just like go all the way up.
Yeah, maybe they'll have that African
tattoo.
And then maybe what is that chicken?
Oh, it's chicken. I mean, are you, do you eat only fowl? I think it would be halal.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, wait.
I would think it would be
halal. They won't be going soon today.
Yeah. I feel like, because when I first came to Cape Town, I was actually shocked at how much the Muslim population
is like very
dominant. Yeah.
Yeah. You should stay.
It was so much easier.
I can imagine.
Because in Canada, we would break like at 9.
It's like
summer
days. Not even like summer, like 8 o'clock later.
By like 6, I was like, I'm not moving. I'm not doing anything. I was just in my bed. I was like, wait, just my like, no, I don't want to cook. I don't want to do anything. I just want to eat.
Hey, what's your roommate too?
Yes, I have two roommates. I have one guy who's Christian, but I have another girl who's from Pakistan and she's Muslim. So we were fasting together, and my roommate, like, the last day of Ramadan, he was like, I'll fast with you guys.
Oh, thanks. A bit late. Thank you.
That's what I always say. I'm like, so, whenever he's eating, like, I'm so sorry. I'm like, if you were really sorry, you wouldn't be eating at all.
That's so cool.
How was your Eid though?
What did you do? Did you like travel in any way?
Well, for Eid, like, I just, because a lot of the interns that are here, we have a lot of them in the food too. So we just all went out to dinner, and then we just went out dancing.
So that like,
because I really like to dance. I really like to dance, and I'm like, Cape Town, like, where can I go to dance? And they're like, oh, I've been to Machi, which is like fun, but I don't know like what the good clubs are. Do you go to dance? No. What kind of music do you like? It could be like ASAP Rocky and
when I'm getting to dance.
I always have those moments like every day. I'm mad. I listen to like a really angry rapper. It's a day. Yeah, it's great. It depends on what areas you are like on. Where I'm staying is a pretty small town. So it's not very big. But like in the larger cities.
I was giving you the character. That's what I called you. My opinion, to be honest.
Yeah, in the larger cities, you have a huge Muslim population.
Mm-hmm.
There's one, in Ottawa, which is the capital. There's like, I think they said there's more Lebanese people there than there are actually than more Lebanese people in Ottawa. The second largest Lebanese population, I'll just put it that way. We compare it to Lebanon, yeah. And it's all the time, like, how bad, shawarma and halal, and I was like, thank God, because I just love shawarma.
So good.
So
we also
I haven't done all the touristy things yet. It's so much cold. July.
Yay!
No, I'll be January. Yeah.
It must stop in like December. Mm-hmm. Apparently this year they have a lot of breaks because the elections aren't this year.
Yes,
so probably it's really busy. So they can have a shot. I don't know when the next break is.
Yeah, because I like, told them the dates that he gave the man. I know that's not right. That's so nice.
Yeah.
I think it's very criticized.
Definitely not. So I'll just text Michelle and tell her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on break right now. Mm-hmm.
What did you say you studied?
I studied international development in Canada, so pretty much the relationship between different countries and how, yeah, no. Because every time I tell people, they're like, what's that?
Tell me what the name is.
Thank you, like, the first person to say that, honestly, every time I tell people, they're like, so, like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know.
But you also not like, really sure what direction I'm
going to. Like, I know that, I knew down to renting a car. Oh my gosh. Okay, I'll answer this later. I knew that, like, at first I was always like, I want to come back home, like I want to come back to Africa and work, that's what I said first.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still open to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I want to do is I want to work in within like the humanitarian aid, that's what I want to do. Just because Parliament is good and everything, but I find it a little bit boring. Cause, like,
the only thing about Parliament is that it's stable. You can see people there as well. And not to actually go and ask
I totally agree. No, it's like, because I'm a poor student. It's so many loans that I have to pay, and I'm just like, you know, and so, if I have to just take a stable job, that is boring, but I get a stable job, but an exciting job that's not stable, and I don't know when my next thing is coming, I totally offer up a boring job.
You need to for now, especially you need to like keep the stability.
It's
really sad. So sad. That's so sad.
I'm with you. Okay,
Okay, let us resume our preparations. Then go proceed. We must deal with the status of this document. Notes on the Australian legal profession. Because Honorable didn't present this. And then we didn't find anything that would assist the committee. So we don't want the draft to be accused of not having taken into account a submission of the TA. Say something, Christine. Okay, Honorable,
this is the first done by our
nothing wrong with the research. We appreciate it. All I'm saying is that you presented it. We didn't find anything that should change our position on anything.
But you haven't even read it.
So I have read it.
The next clause is clause 36. It is in chapter 4 that deals with professional conduct and the establishment of disciplinary bodies. Clause 36, there's nothing that was flagged there. Clause 37 was discussed again at the previous meeting of the committee, and some changes were made and proposed there. The big change that was proposed was by the Honourable Smith, that discipline be delegated down to the regional council level, and then the change that Big Bill Font was actually to accommodate that request for an alternative is similar to the other clauses, but it just provides that the regional council must, when necessary, establish investigating committee, etc. And then also on the next page, paragraph C of the new 1BA is to accommodate the regional council idea. The committee has to decide on this, so it's indicated regional council or council.
I thought yesterday we agreed that we need the provincial council, but that these structures will be progressively implemented. So to use the word must would create problems. Why wouldn't we say may, so that where they don't exist, there's nothing to delegate, and where they exist, you may, you then have the power to delegate.
Chair, for you, but Dr. Shirley, you delegate to those that do it, because remember, as currently drafted, it says that there must be at least three or four provincial panels, and on your thinking and my thinking, we must incrementally move to a situation where we have nine. But there will be three or four to begin with. They're going to be based on the current law society infrastructure. And the essential point that I'm trying to argue is that we can't, as the bill currently does, require the National Legal Practice Council to conduct all the investigations to see if there's a prima facie case against someone, because there will be simply too many of them. We know that the Law Society of the Northern Provinces alone receives 8,000 complaints in a year, and so therefore if you multiply that by for the existing law societies, that at least 30,000 arguments, for argument's sake, 30,000 complaints. Now, I don't think it's realistic for the National Legal Council to investigate 30,000 complaints to see if they have substance and to reduce the number down to the couple of hundred that then actually become disciplinary inquiries. So my proposal is quite simply that essentially that complaints, I think in practice complaints would go directly to the provincial councils, but if you wish, they could be sent, emailed to the national council, which must then send them down at first to the three or four provincial councils, later to the nine provincial councils. So it's a logistical thing.
I don't think we define just that if you are establishing the structure, sometimes there may be problems of capacity at the beginning. So to use the word may is just to avoid a situation where you make it mandatory and the other people don't have the capacity to do what you mandate them to do. So I don't think we should fight right, but it's just a drafting matter.
Chair, I take the committee back to 23.1, page 26 of draft 3, which says the council establishes regional councils and may delegate to those regional councils such powers and functions which, in the interest of legal profession, are going to perform at regional level. So that is the inherent function and power given to your national council. It covers the issue raised by members as to whether a region exists or not. So that's the all-encompassing power that's with the National Council. And I think inherent in this is the fact that we know that the National Council will delegate discipline of executive affairs to regional councils. The only concern I have relating to giving the regional councils inherent jurisdiction it relates to the fact that it should vest with the national structure, and of course 23 deals with the way in which it believes the regions ought to be delegated with power. It covers that, so I don't see the necessity to create inherent jurisdiction to the regional councils, because it's covered in any case by 23. And the national council will, in its discretion, delegate those powers as it would in regard to discipline, because it cannot attend to that. But in the absence of a region not having a regional council, the national council might very well create committees that will sit in those regions. So I don't think we should take away the power from the national council to actually deal with it in a manner in which it deems fit. I say again, it's covered by 23.
So what, in short, what are you saying in respect of 37?
All that I'm saying is that power should simply read the council and not regional council. It should be the council.
Yeah.
It's written 37.1. Sounds like council must set up the investigating committees itself. The council must, when necessary, establish investigating committees consisting of. Now, surely you're not going to, if you devolve now this function to the region, you're not establishing investigating committees. You're asking the provincial council to establish investigating committees.
Chair, that could be further amended to the council or where delegate authority vests in regional councils. That would take care of it.
The issue is that we don't give the regional council an original authority. The authority vested at the national level, and then it may be delegated.
Thank you, Chair. It's basically the same as Mr. Dyer said. The moment, even though the bill would be the council must, the moment the council formally delegates that function, in actual fact, this would then read the delegated regional council. So the original power vests with the council. So, for example, there's a complaint in a small vicinity. The council might decide to delegate that whole or send that whole investigation to another province if there's allegations of bias or collusion or whatever. So the regional power remains with the council. But once it's delegated, for all purposes, it will be dealt with at regional level.
So what are we saying? Are we saying that we're not going to actually label anything regional council anymore? It will just be the council. And in terms of 23.1, that's when it articulates that the council must, subject to Section 2, establish regional councils and may delegate to the regional councils such powers and functions. Because then it actually says that all these funds, every way raise regional council, we know that there will be delegated powers for the regional councils.
Okay. The actual bill, as it was introduced, it didn't give any regional powers to the regional councils, but to the council. And then the power to delegate.
Okay, Miss Lowe.
Chair, at the bottom of page 43, there's a further alternative to paragraph B, where, let me just start at the beginning, subclause 2 reads, an investigating committee must, after investigating a complaint, if it is satisfied that a legal practitioner, etc., might be guilty of misconduct, refer the matter to the council for adjudication by a disciplinary committee, or, and then the new alternative was that the complaint should be dismissed on the grounds that misconduct does not necessarily warrant misconduct proceedings, and then the complainant may appeal in terms of section 42 if a complainant is aggrieved. That was an alternative that was inserted. And then at the last meeting on 15 August, an alternative to the whole subclause 4 was inserted to read, an investigating committee must, after investigating a complaint, if it is satisfied that the legal practitioner, etc., might be guilty of misconduct, refer the matter to the regional council. So this is just the same as it was, but it gives the regional council the regional powers to deal with the matter. So this is as we discussed just now. And similarly, the alternative to subclause 3 is the same, but it gives it to the regional council.
Questions or comments?
Why did you say, just for convenience, use the top of the page, the second line? The complaint should be dismissed on the ground that the misconduct in question does not necessarily warrant misconduct proceedings. Don't we mean the conduct in question does not? Yeah.
Thank you. Chair, the next clause is 38, procedure for dealing with complaints of misconduct. At the last meeting, there was only one insertion in subclause 3D3 at the top of page 47, just technical drafting, relevant regional councils, and further there was no serious things that were flagged at the last meeting. Same with clause 39, disciplinary hearing, nothing big there. And then the next one is clause 40, proceeding after disciplinary hearing. At the previous meeting, subclause 3 was discussed on page 51. And in subclause B, there was an insertion that the council must apply to the High Court for an order to compensation to the complainant, which order is subject to the confirmation of the court, just to make clear that the council brings this application. Only basically a technical amendment. Clause 41, review by legal services ombud. This matter, this clause has been deleted. It's dealt with at another place. Clause 42, appeal against conduct or decision or finding of a committee or a disciplinary committee. There were several amendments, but at this stage nothing is flagged there. Also clauses 43, 44, and 45.
Okay.
Chapter 5 deals with the legal services ombud. Clauses 46 and 47 has no flagged alternatives. Clause 48 deals with the appointment of the independence of the ombud. And there was an alternative option to subclause 1.
On this matter, I don't understand why it isn't obvious that a retired judge is what you want as the ombud. But in spite of that, there's an appointment provision here that requires 5 names for the president to choose from. And these people may be anything ranging from a judge discharged to an advocate or attorney with 10 years' experience. A person with specialized knowledge in the administration of justice. Now, I mean, my first question is why? To me, it's so obvious that this has to be a discharged judge. What is the argument for, please remind me, for considering other people? But the second question, why must the president receive 5 names to choose from and then appoint? I mean, what is the executive's interest in the legal profession, and specifically in the post of the ombud, who's going to do ombud-type functions? What is the executive's interest in this? Why should the president have here 5 names to choose from?
I think we also need to be practical, because if we talk about at the end, 9 provincial council. You are not necessarily going to have the judges that are available everywhere. So I think the wet person include also a retired judge. So it's not necessary to be so specific as to say retired judge, but a person would include that. But also the executive has a duty to implement the law, and this law needs to be implemented by someone. And also if you give the president 1 name of a retired judge, if that judge is not available, then you keep on submitting names. You can take the whole year submitting names, but you submit enough names so that you look at the suitability and the availability of people. So there's nothing strange about that. I think it's what has happened in the normal course of government, so we should allow it to go that way.
Andrew,
if it's a judge, then you don't even need this whole appointment process under which a joint committee of parliament advertises, invites nominations, you know, that's the thing we normally do. If it's going to be a retired judge, Parliament doesn't choose, don't invite nominations of judges and interview a lot of judges and decide which judge. That's not how it works. If it's a discharged judge, then the appointment quite simply occurs in whatever the normal mechanism is, which is, I think, the President and the Minister of Justice. They get to choose the judge, but a judge is a judge. And everybody has confidence in the judge because he is a judge. And the reason why a judge is suitable for the legal services ombud is that the courts have inherent jurisdiction over the legal profession. They understand the profession. There is that long-standing historic relationship between them. And a retired judge, as like an active judge, is a person who is above reproach and disinterested and whom everybody trusts. So you can appoint any discharged judge, and then you don't need Parliament to sit on this process. And if you look at the middle footnote, the PC did indicate a preference for a judge in this position, and the matter was flagged.
I think Parliament has an inherent right to oversee the executive. So even in regard to the appointment of that judge, Parliament still has that responsibility. So let's not remove parliament, because our country is complicated. The president will appoint a person, and somebody comes and say no, they appointed the Ashudat, and then we have another controversy. But I think to protect the government, and also to make sure that parliament does not lose its right to oversee, let's just leave this clause with the understanding that the preference would be a third judge.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause is for...
I'd just like to get clarity on our drafting, or as far as this clause is concerned, Chair. Do we take out the judge in paragraph A of subclause 2-4?
No, I don't think that's what Russell was going to say. Because he was saying the understanding is that the preference is in fact the judge. But he wants Parliament still to go through the process correctly. Yeah. My preference would be thus straightforward appointment by the executive of a discharged judge.
So I would tend to agree that appointment mechanism isn't appropriate if a judge is mentioned like that.
Yeah.
No, if we're going to keep the appointment process as indicated in subclause 1, I'm concerned about its linkage with subclause 2A. If we mention a judge, I don't think it is appropriate for that to be mentioned, for a judge to be mentioned in that type of appointment process.
That's correct. And so therefore the two options we have is A, a judge appointed by the president on the advice of the Minister of Justice. B, this process where the judge is now not one of the lineup. Yeah. And the choice then becomes really for me very clear. I mean, it must be a judge. But it means can we have, I'm so sorry to ask for drafting, but can we have that simple option, discharge judge appointed by the president?
Okay. Shall we then proceed?
Thank you, Chair. Clause 49 deals with powers and functions of the Ombud. There is an alternative to subclause 1 in this clause. Subclause 1 states, in addition to the other powers and functions conferred on or assigned to him under this Act and for purposes of achieving the objects referred to in Section 47, the Ombud may investigate any matter out of unaccord on the receipt of a complaint, investigate any alleged failure by those bodies, must investigate any complaint by a court, may report and make recommendations to the minister, must in the case of failure by a disciplinary body report and make recommendations, may review a decision of the relative fund board, may make recommendations to the council on steps to promote the high standards of the profession, and may refer the matters to the NDA. Then the PC requested an option and it would like to, the PC wants, the committee wants to look at this further, consider it. An alternative was that in addition to the other powers and functions conferred and for purposes of achieving the objects of this Act, the Ombud is competent to investigate on its own initiative any maladministration, abuse or omission. And then the Ombud may use mediation or make advise any person on appropriate remedies or any other expedient means. And then at any time prior to during or after an investigation, the Ombud may intervene if he or she is of the opinion that the facts disclose an offence or deems it advisable to refer the matter which has a bearing on investigation to the appropriate body or authority. And if it's opinion that the substance in any complaint made to the prejudice of the complainant or other person that's adversely affected, and it affects the independence of the legal profession and public perceptions, to anything necessary to enable proceedings. So that is an alternative that has to be considered.
Just to remind committee members the history of this, originally the bill introduced gave the ombud also review powers, or let's call them appeal powers, in cases of disciplinary hearings, and there was a strong view in the committee that the ombud shouldn't have those powers. The appeal power procedures or review procedures in terms of disciplinary matters must stay within the legal profession, and that we must have a look as drafters at an alternative regarding the powers and functions of the ombud. And it was suggested that the ombud should really play a more ombud, conventional ombud type role, similar to that of the public protector, where the ombud has recommendatory powers rather than decision-making powers. So when the drafters redrafted this provision, we did so on the basis of the public protector, and I think a little bit from the Human Rights Commission, and this is the product of that, where the powers and functions are really recommendatory and nothing more than that. And the committee indicated that it would still need time to reflect on this and take a decision.
And simultaneously
create an appeal mechanism for.
There was an appeal mechanism originally, but that appeal mechanism was only for use by the legal practitioner, and we requested to draft, which we did, the appeal mechanism now can be used by the complainant and the legal practitioner, and the appeal mechanism to the ombud falls away.
Thank you, Chair. The next clause is Clause 50, Remuneration and Evidence and Conditions of Employment of the Ombud. At the previous meeting of the committee on 15 August, the committee requested an alternative to Sub-Clause 4. Sub-Clause 4 has introduced reads, the Ombud holds office for the period determined by the President. The committee then changed it to a period of 7 years, renewable once, and then the committee requested a further alternative to read the ombud holds office for a non-renewable period of 7 years.
I think A, it should be a right, and B, it should be a non-renewable of 7 years. The emphasis is on independence.
Any further comments?
I should really convince you to one to attach it. I would agree that the period would not be, unless if you are saying we say none is renewable because he's a judge anyway, he will be old already. I don't know, understand why honorable Dean. Maybe if you can explain yourself best.
In any of the independent offices would carry security tenure, it is usually considered desirable to have a non-renewable term, like the Auditor General is one example. Public Protector is another example. They serve their one term with security of tenure, and then they go.
I think it would be
cleaner if we keep to this formulation. You know, for instance, when you say the ombudsman may, if he or she, but I think it's understood that the preference would be a judge if he's there's one appropriate one available. But it's specified in the text that it must be a retired judge. I don't think it's a question. I don't know if we could keep what is here.
Doctor, it's either or. It's either a judge or it's that other appointment mechanism where Parliament interviews and you take an advocate or attorney with any other experience, someone experienced in the administration of justice, etc. Because we've now agreed that you can't make a judge one of the possibilities if it's that kind of procedure. When a discharged judge gets appointed to fulfill a function for the nation, then the president with the Minister of Justice appoints him.
What is the advice of the doctor?
Their advice. Therefore, we have two options.
My understanding, Chair, was that which clause was it?
This was
clause 50. In clause 48. I raised the question, if we're going to keep the appointment mechanism in sub-clause 1 where the President appoints after an ad hoc committee of Parliament submits 5 names to the President for appointment as ombud, that appointment mechanism would be inappropriate if a retired judge is mentioned as a possibility. And my understanding is that the committee agreed that we do 2 options. One, where you have this mechanism that we've got there with an ad hoc committee and nomination process, but then you wouldn't mention a judge. And it would just be any person who is admitted as an attorney or an advocate or is qualified to be admitted. And then the other option would be is that the president would appoint a judge, and it would only be limited to a judge, and those are the 2 options that we've been asked now to prepare. That is my understanding.
Thank you, Chair. Clauses 51-52 as no contentious matters that were flagged.
I don't know why we don't seem to have discussed this before, but we certainly cannot have a situation where the President may remove the ombud for misconduct or inability, incapacity, essentially, with no checks and balances whatsoever. I don't know how this happens. Is it just that we've never discussed it? You can't have the President just removing somebody, suspending him after the commencement of any proceedings instituted against the ombud. What proceedings? Am I missing something? And if he's suspended, he can't exercise his powers. And if the office becomes vacant, the President is